Hello, everybody. It's Gary Stuckey with Real Music. Hope you're doing okay wherever you are today. I've got a great show lined up for you right now. I've got Ricky Medlock of Lynyrd Skynyrd and Blackfoot here today. He's talking about a brand new single called Never Run Out of Road in support of the missing and murdered Indigenous women movement. And he's been behind that for a while, and it's a great cause, helping out. And you can check out his website for more information. Also, we're going to discuss his career. You know, when you're in two cool bands like Lynyrd Skynyrd and Blackfoot, and you're successful, you know, he was there at the beginning of Lynyrd Skynyrd. You know, he left and came back with them now. But Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, there's some controversy there. We're going to talk about that, and some stories that maybe you didn't know. But it was a great conversation, and I think you're going to appreciate it. So here we go. Here he is. Here's Ricky Medlock.
First of all, let's talk about you've got a new single out, and I really do like that song, Never Run Out of Road. Is this song about your life?
Well, actually, the song started with a music idea that I had, and I love writing with other writers, of course, and I always have, because, you know, I can come up with music and riffs and licks and phrases and stuff like that all day long when it comes to writing. But, you know, I've worked with some of them. I feel like, as a matter of fact, I feel like I worked with one of the best lyricists, meaning Ronnie Van Zant, that I believe ever wrote a song. In my own opinion, like Gary always said, you get one genius in a family, you've done a lot, you know. And for a guy such as Ronnie to have been so young when he wrote all those lyrics, 4 years, if you really think about it, you know, and before the first record come out, but before that. So you realize, let's say 6 to 7 years of writing lyrics, okay? And I was there for some of it in the early years, because I was one of the original early drummers in the band. So I watched him, and he was like an old soul. He was like a guy that had already matured into his 50s and 60s being able to write those lyrics. But here's the guy, you know, he sadly left us at the age of 29, and he'd written all these great lyrics that, and you look at it as, here's a young guy that just had so much insight in depth of being able to write these lyrics. And I tell you what I equate it to, you know, it's almost like, if you can think about it in these terms, it's almost like a guy, an artist with an easel, and he's sitting there painting this picture, and all of a sudden you see it visibly. There it is. Ronnie was a guy that was able to write those lyrics and paint the picture that in your mind you could see. So to me, that's genius. And so I've worked with some pretty prominent people when it comes to writing lyrics. And, you know, Charlie Starr was the guy that I went to when I had this idea, Charlie Starr from Blackberry Smoke. And I went to Charlie, and Charlie and I had been friends for quite a while. And as a matter of fact, he even did a song on their first record called Bottom of This, written by a friend of mine, another great writer out of Nashville named Gordon Kennedy. And Charlie and them, on their very first record, put out that song that Gordon and I wrote. Well, Charlie was kind of a go-to guy, and I had fed him music, and he would doodle, he would mess around with the lyrics and pass them back, and then I'd pass them back. And so this last record, not this one they got out currently, but the one before this one, he wrote a song, me and him wrote a song together called Old Scarecrow. And it was on their record. So when I had the music to this, I passed it over to Charlie. And I told him my idea, you know, about, you know, both of us could relate about being on the road. And, you know, so when you're a traveling musician, of course, you never run out of road. You know what I mean?
Right.
So
that's right.
Charlie, you know, messed around with the lyrics and got it back. And I had sat on the song, oh gosh, good 6 or 7 years. Finally, when I wanted to do a side project, I went to one of my former guitar players that had been in some of the latter versions of Blackfoot. And I went to this guy, Mark Warple, and he's out of the Minneapolis area. And I went to Mark, and I knew Mark had a band. And I called Mark one day and I said, look, you know, when Skinner goes on hiatus, I have to have something to do. I said, I just, you know, I can only fish so much, and right. I cannot not play. I mean, playing music and being out there on stage and playing that guitar is like, that's my ultimate, you know. So I said to Mark, let's put together. I knew Mark had a band. And I said, Mark, what if I interjected myself into your band and we work up a set and, you know, go out and play some shows when I'm off the road with Skinner? He said, I love the idea. Let me call my band and see what the guys think. He said, they're coming over tonight, and I'll kind of give them the heads up on what I'm thinking. And then when they get here, we'll discuss it and I'll let you know. He told them, they said, great idea. Let's do this. So we started year before last in October of 22, started working up a show, a set. And then we knew we were going to have something in our hip pocket to go out and make the dates worthwhile and promote, you know, so forth and so on. So mm-hmm. Mark came down here to my studio. As a matter of fact, I'm in my studio right now. And Mark came down here, and we started going through my library, my outer drives, my outer hard drives, full of songs. And this one came up. And Mark says, what is this? And I said, it's a song that Charlie Starr and I co-wrote together, called Never Run Out of Road. And we listened to it. Mark had some good ideas about some changes in it and stuff like that. And we passed it back and forth to each other, him up there and me down here in Florida. Right. Thank God for the new technology of Pro Tools. So, you know, right. We collaborated on different lyrics. We put it all together, mixed it, had the song, and then in comes a guy named Scott Harold. Scott Harold owns Rock the Cause Records, and they're distributed by Sony. And he said, look, I'd like to put this song out. And so between my manager, Scott, and me and Mark, we came to an agreement, and the agreement was, Scott, every time he does a song on somebody, he gets them to agree to donate to one of their favorite charities. And mine happened to be, you know, stuff for natives, because I'm 2/3 native. And you know what? It's always been very important. You know, I mean, I've never professed to be full native, and I'm not. But I'm proud of being Lakota, Creek, Cherokee, Scottish, and English. You know, I ended up getting all the band combo parts. I'm a mutt. So anyway,
it's dangerous.
so I had tried to do a TV show called Women Erased about the MMIW, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women movement. And I kind of got cut out of it by the production team and as the host and narrator. And to be honest with you, it kind of originally had been my idea. And goes to show you about the business, you know. So I said, wow, okay, cut me out, will you? All right. So you know, kind of pulled my bootstraps up and I said, well, at some point something's going to come about. And sure enough, here it was. And the first thing I thought of, wow, I'd like to donate to a real reputable charity, you know. But at that time, I was involved with a real incredible company called Green River Enterprise from up in Canada. And these are all these. This is a native organization by the Eight Nations of the Seneca. And they've done wonderful in their life with their products. And they're over a $1 billion company. But they have a charitable fund. They have a charitable fund called the Dream Catchers Charitable Fund. So I'd already been involved with that. But I wanted something, you know, a little something to really go out here and possibly find that can really make a good difference. You know what I mean? With women, with the women. So I got a very, very good friend of mine. I'm very good friends with a lot of your native actors and actresses. And I went to this really good friend of mine. His name is Gil Birmingham, and you'll recognize him. He started, some people will go, well, who is he not? Well, go to the Twilight series, and he was the father of the wolves, the guy in the wheelchair, okay? Yeah. He's been in countless movies. And one of the movies that had to do with what the subject that you and I are talking about, he was in a movie with Jeremy Renner called Wind River. And he was the father of a missing and then found murdered indigenous daughter. And so I called Gil. He's now on Yellowstone. He plays the tribal chairman. The tribal chairman of, you know, the Cheyennes that Dutton's always having a problem with, you know. Well, they had done an episode on season 3, and in particular about this subject. And I called up Gil and I said, Gil, this is what I'm about to do, and I'm trying to do this. Can you tell me a really good, reputable organization that I can put the proceeds to? He said, you know what? I know that Taylor does, Taylor Sheridan. Let me call Taylor and I'll find out for you. So he called Taylor. Taylor Sheridan called him back. He called me back within a couple of days. Said, Ricky, Taylor donates to the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. I went, really? He goes, yep. He said, this one is about as reputable as you can get. So I chose that one. So now we got three organizations that the proceeds are going to: the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center, the Dream Catchers Charitable Organization, and the Save the North American Wolves Organization, because I'm big into animals. Awesome. And so there you go. If you go to my website, rickymedlock.com, you'll see the links. If you go on YouTube, I think the links are on YouTube with the song. We have merchandise that if you buy the T-shirts or the caps or hoodies or whatever, that goes to it. And I'm just really proud to be a part of, I mean, it's small. It's not, you know, making billions of dollars, but it is feeding into their charity, and it's something small, and it's just my way of, in some small way, of having a voice you know, to go out there and make people aware of the epidemic that this is placed upon indigenous people, because this has been going on for probably better than 100 years. And it's an atrocity. If you can think about it in these terms, natives make up less than 10% of the population of this country. And in that 10%, 40% of those are women, meaning older women, middle-aged women, young women, or young girls and boys that have gone missing. And some found deceased. That's a large number. You know what I mean?
Wow.
And it never gets the right kind of investigation from the federal government. And it's become such an epidemic. And I just trying to do my part in bringing awareness to it, and put out this song. And there you go. That's it.
Awesome. That it's a great song, by the way. And it really, but the message, I guess it ties in too with that. It's a good song. I've seen a documentary about, I think it was on Dateline, one of those kind of shows, where there was this lady that was going out, her niece was missing and she was indigenous and she couldn't find her, but she went out and helped others find their kids, you know, and then they found her niece, and it was sad, and they didn't really care, you know. It was like nobody cared, you know, to find.
No, they don't. All these they missing. Don't. I know. And it's a sad deal. It's a very sad deal, and my heart breaks for these people. You know, I mean, if at all, the bottom line, those families need some kind of closure. You know. And it's just a sad deal all the way around. It is.
Right. Well, I know that with your help, you know, they're gonna get a lot of help with you and everybody checking that out. But way to go once again on that, helping them out. That's really good. Really good idea too. That's really good.
Thank you. Yeah, man.
But since you got a little time, you know, we're gonna kind of go down this route. You know, you were talking earlier about Ronnie, and you know, I know recently with the passing of Gary Rossington, you know, so sad. I know a lot of people were like, he was the last original member, but then you, what about you, right? I mean, did you kind of say, I was there at the beginning, did you kind of wave that flag and go, hello, I'm over here?
Well, you know, not long before Gary passed away, Gary went on video. His family filmed it, and he went on video because I guess his daughters had seen people arguing over, you know, the fact that I wasn't, you know, in the original band, and people arguing, oh, yes, he was, you know. And so Gary went on video. I've got it. And Gary went on video and said, look, as far as we're, he said, I want to come here to settle this argument. He goes, we always considered Ricky an original member. And he goes, I'm just here to put a stop to all this discussion. Well, this kind of started back when the band was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame deemed it unnecessary to put me in because they said my importance and tenure in the band did not qualify me to go in. So,
wow.
I remember sitting there that night thinking to myself, what a slap in the face. You know, I gave up my whole life for this art called music. I've sold millions of records, you know, even with my own band, Blackfoot, much less Lynyrd Skynyrd. I was there in the beginning. I played drums on all those early tracks. I sang background vocals. I sang even lead vocals on stuff. I played guitar. And for an organization to be that biased, okay, and that's what I call it. I call it being very negative and very biased. And for them to do that, that's like a huge, I mean, I'm having to sit at the table watching my band up there going into the Rock Hall of Fame. I mean, they even inducted Steve Gaines, who had only been there maybe a year, and he's going in the Rock Hall of Fame, but I'm not, you know? And I'll tell you who else didn't go in was the original bass player, Larry Johnstrom. Larry,
wow,
that went on to be with 38 Special, he was the original guy. So I took that as I'm sitting there watching this. That was a huge, you know, slap to my face by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So the only thing that kind of took it away a little bit from my frustration and anger that night. Of course, you get up and you play at the Rock Hall of Fame when the ceremony, you know, they hand you your trophy and all that stuff. You know, the only thing that kind of took away from it, we played Sweet Home Alabama and we played Freebird. And I, of course, I'm up there playing the lead to Freebird. And when Freebird was over with, I'm walking off stage, handing my guitar tech my guitar, and a young man approached me. And he was one of the ushers and stuff there, you know, at the Rock Hall. He goes, "Excuse me, Mr. Medlock." I said, "Yeah." He goes, "There's a man over here. There's a gentleman over here that wants to shake your hand." And I went, "Well, who is it?" He goes, "He didn't want me to tell you." So I'm thinking, okay. So I follow the guy out, you know, and as we turn, here sits Ozzy and the guys from Sabbath. And Ozzy stood up and shook my hand and saying, "Great job, you know." Walk a little further. Here's Sting. Sting stood up. One of my all-time heroes, you know, favorite writers, favorite lyricists, singers. And he shakes my hand. And so we walk a little further. And the next thing I know, this gentleman stands up, big, tall guy. Could have been a basketball player. It's none other than Brian May.
Wow.
And I went, wow, oh, my God. And I'm always,
wow,
I guess I should say I'm always with people that I've admired and had so much respect for. I've always been in awe of people when they, you know, want to meet me or whatever, you know. And Brian May stuck his hand out. He's got huge hands. And he stuck his hand out and he said, "I want to shake the hand that just played that long solo in Freebird." He goes, "Oh my gosh."
Wow.
And I went, "Forget that. I want to shake the hand that played all that Queen stuff." You know? I mean, I was
not
like,
worthy, not worthy.
Forget me. You know? But later on, within about 6 months, through a really good friend of mine, Paul Crook, Brian May gave me his number 3 guitar out of his vault. And I've got it.
Wow.
I've got it in my guitar room. And
wow,
it's one of my most prized possessions, you know? So
jeez.
Yeah.
So cool.
Yeah, man.
You're talking about meeting him. You know, I'm sitting here talking to you and I'm like, you were with him, because I mean, hey, by the way, Train is my go-to song. I play guitar and sing, and I've sung that song many times. And if I had known that I'd be talking to you one day, I wouldn't have believed it, but that is my go-to. I love that song, by the way. Train is just
God
phenomenal.
God bless my, God bless my granddaddy, Shorty Medlock. You know, he's the one that wrote it. My granddaddy Shorty was, he was born and raised on a sharecropping farm up in Georgia. He was born in 1912, and it was him and four other siblings. My great grandmother and great grandfather lived up there, and they sharecropped a farm up there for a gentleman that owned all the land, that lived up on the hill in the big house, and you know, and right across the road from them was an African American family that sharecropped right along with them. So they were like two peas in a pod. Well, on Sundays, my great grandmother and the lady, the mother of that family, would get together and they would cook for everybody. And they would come over to the shack over across the road where my great grandparents lived and all the kids. They would eat and they'd sit on the porch and play music. Well, the following Sunday, it was just the reverse. So this is the way my grandfather grew up. He grew up dirt poor. I mean, he grew up sharecropping, you know, going out in the fields and in that hot sun and working his butt off, and you know, but he also learned, right. He also learned the Delta blues, bluegrass country, you know, existed, you know what I mean? So
right.
My great-grandfather, great-grandmother, they left the sharecropping farm when my dad was about 9 years old, 8 or 9 years old, 10 years old, something like that. And they left in a covered wagon and made their way all the way down from Northwest Georgia, all the way down to south of Gainesville, Florida, in a little town called Rochelle, Florida. And my granddaddy Shorty and his brother, my uncle, they actually worked for the author, Marjorie Rollins, that wrote The Yearling. She lived in Cross Creek. And she wrote a book, and I'm trying to think of the title, but she wrote this book where she mentions the Medlock boys working in her yard, working for her. Cool. And pretty wild. Well, he went on to, you know, extend his playing of music, being in bands. And the thing about my grandfather is, my granddaddy Shorty, thing about him is that he not only played, oh gosh, what, seven different instruments? But he not only played them, he played them incredibly well. He became a go-to guy by other musicians out of Nashville or other artists out of Nashville as a road guy. And if they needed a banjo player, call Shorty. They needed a fiddle player, call Shorty. If they needed a guitar player, call Shorty. You know what I mean? So when he'd be on the road, he would come back, and he had his own band. Now, I'm growing up around all this. So to give you a little piece of history, and I got pictures of it right here on this one of these things. My granddaddy was on a local TV show. And I was about 3 years old when this all happened, but my granddaddy had noticed when I was a young boy how his banjo would be laying there. And as a young boy, I'd climb up on the sofa and I would pick at the strings. I wouldn't just hit it and fram on it and da-da to make a bunch of noise. He and my grandmother noticed that I would just pluck on strings and I would listen. I'd pluck on another one and, you know. So he told my grandma, he goes, I'm gonna do something. So he found me a miniature banjo something my little hands would hold, you know. And he started teaching me the basics, you know, of a banjo. And he and we learned a couple of songs together and learned to sing them together. I'm a little kid at 3 years old, and I'm standing there next to my granddaddy, and I'm just like, you know, not finger picking like he did or whatever, but I'm framming it, you know, and I'm doing pretty good. So he goes to the guy that he's on a national that was broadcast all over the South, Southeast, Mid-South, down to your lower South. And it was called the Toby Dowdy Show. And it was simulcast over WMBR, which was a CBS affiliate. Well, MBR has become WJXT out of Jacksonville. Well, he goes to Toby one night before the show went on the air. He said, "Toby, I've taught my grandson how to play banjo." And Toby says, "Your grandson, how old is he?" He said, "He's 3. And we've worked up a couple of songs together. I'd like to bring him on here and let me and him, you know, play and sing one of these songs." Toby goes, "You got to be kidding." He goes, "No, I'm not." He said, "I'm dead serious." So Toby thought in his head, he goes, "Well, if Shorty's telling me this, it's got to be dead on." So the following week, I go on the show with my granddad, and we do a song. And that week, the cards and letters came into the TV station. "We want to see little Ricky, you know, again." And that name kind of stuck with me till I got to be 6'2", you know? So I went on there, and I stayed there for 5 years until I was 8 years old on that show. And I never looked back. Within that time period, my daddy had a beautiful old, about a night, and we still got it in the family. My better half has it with her. She won't turn it loose now. You couldn't pry it away from her. But my granddaddy had a beautiful old J45 Gibson that he always played. And it would be laying around, and I started wanting to play guitar. And he showed me 3 chords. He showed me G, C, and D. And then after that, when he showed them to me and I pretty well got them down, he goes, "Okay, you're on your own." I'm like, "What? You know, you got to be kidding." But he had guitar players in his bands that I would watch them play, and I would listen to the radio, and I'd listen to guitar players play on the radio. And I was a big, you know, I was so into Elvis Presley at a young age. And to make a long story short with you, my granddaddy ended up with 3 tickets to see Elvis at the Florida Theater in 1956 and took me for an early birthday present. My birthday was in February. I turned 7, and this was in December of 56. And I got to see the king when the king was really the king, you know?
Awesome.
And when we left that night, my granddaddy said, "Well, son, what did you think of that?" And I said, "That's what I want to do. I want to do that." And I never looked back. I never forgot, you know, at such a young age, I never forgot my focus. I never forgot what I wanted to do. And thank the heavens for my mom and dad let me explore, you know, what was naturally given to me. They never kept me from it. You know, they always knew that I showed the talent for it and the drive. And they let me go out and do what I do. So, you know, for me, man, I've had an incredible, incredible life in music. I love the art of music. You know, I never started out, this is an interesting thing, and I never gave it any thought, but I mean, I never started out to be a rock star. You know, I just wanted to play music. And I thought in my life I was going to have a guitar and I was going to have an amp and I was going to join this band, that band, this band, that band. And I'd play a club and then get my money at the end of the night, pack up my guitar and my amp. I'd walk out. I'd go home, go to bed. Well,
right.
Little did I know in my life, and nobody ever knows that, you know? But my granddad explained it to me one time. He goes, look, he said, you got an extra special kiss from God when you came out of your mama's womb. And that's where you are. So
right.
Here I am sitting here today talking to you. I'm 74 years old, and I've had a long history of being in great music and being in good company with a lot of great musicians that I've been able to share the stage with. And to me, that's my greatest accomplishment, to be honest with you, my friend. All the fans and stuff yell, that's the greatest accomplishment. The selling of all the records, yell, that's a good accomplishment, okay? But I've always said my greatest accomplishment was being able to stand on the stage with some of the world's greatest musicians and play next to them. And I will always say that. I will always say that. Yeah.
Right. And they'll say the same thing about you. Well, tell me this. Now, going back to the early years of Lynyrd Skynyrd, now, you're in Lynyrd Skynyrd, so you're playing drums. That's so cool, by the way. And then you left. So why did you decide to leave? You went to Blackfoot. You played with Blackfoot. What was the reason why you decided to leave Lynyrd Skynyrd at that time?
Well, Ronnie and them, they were really enjoying my playing. I had a good sense of timing. My meter was really like spot on. Just I had a serious groove bone, you know, and I still do, I feel. But I have a people are starting to find this out with me, but I have a serious respiratory illness called pulmonary fibrosis, you know? And you got to have a lot of air intake when you play drums. You got to have a lot of air intake and a lot of stamina from the air you breathe, and, you know, the whole bit. And after about 2.5, going on almost 3 years, I had started to notice that, you know, it was hard. It was not that I couldn't do it, but I started thinking to myself, what's going to happen with me? And, you know, here I am almost 23. Am I going to be able to do this when I'm 30? You know? So I made the decision to walk away. And I always knew and really felt in my heart that Ronnie and Gary and Alan, they needed somebody extraordinarily good in that band to take them further, to help take them further. And I went to the guys and I said, I'm going to have to bow out because I can't, you know, it's a struggle for me, you know? So when I made the decision, you know, my granddaddy, Shorty, had been an influence on Ronnie and the guys. I mean, if you listen to Curtis Lowe, Ronnie always said it was due in part to Shorty Medline, the influence.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, if you go to the Nothing Fancy record and look on the album cover, it says dedicated to Shorty Medline. And he always used to say, if you boys keep doing what you're doing, one of these days you're going to have it made in the shade. Well, Ronnie wrote a song on that record called Made in the Shade and also dedicated that to my old man, you know? So when you listen to Curtis Lowe, when you hear the line, he used to play an old dobro, used to play it across his knee. That's my granddad.
Awesome.
So I made the decision that I was going to walk away. It was hard, the hard decision. And because the band's popularity was just getting unbelievable. So my granddaddy said to me, he says, I want you to understand something now. You walk away from this and those guys make it, and you don't, you're going to have to live with that for the rest of your life. And is that going to be something that you can live with that's going, and something that's hard to swallow? And I thought about it real hard. And I told him, I said, you know what, Pop? I believe in me. I believe in my ability, and I believe that somewhere down the road, I'll make it. He said, okay. So I went back to Blackfoot. We spent all that time getting our asses whooped. And finally, in 1978, we signed with Atlantic Records. We had our first record out with Atlantic called On the Strikes record. And the next thing you know, we had two hit songs, Highway Song and Train Train. We sold over a million. We sold over a million records. We went platinum, on our way to double platinum. And understand that, of course, the plane disaster had already happened. And I had feelings about that that I carried with me for a pretty good while. The next thing I know, they put out the Lynyrd Skynyrd's first and last record. And here I am on the front cover of it. So the Rock Hall of Fame got it wrong. Okay. So, you know, all of a sudden, the next thing you know, I've got over here, I've got a Skynyrd record that's two over double platinum, headed toward triple platinum. I got a record over here with Blackfoot that's already platinum, headed toward double platinum. And I'd never had a record. Only thing I ever had was a record that went vinyl. I never had a platinum record. You know what I mean? So I'm sitting on two records, you know, that's just taking off like crazy. And I was just so incredibly appreciative and overwhelmed and just thankful, you know. And I remember my granddaddy says, well, worked out for you, didn't it? And I said, yeah, just like I told you, you know. So, right. You know what, man? Those early years with Skynyrd, it was interesting. I loved playing with them. You know, there is out there, you know, and I have said it, you know, Ronnie invited me to go on that trip with him. And I didn't know up until recently that Johnny had also been invited to go with him, to ride with him.
Oh, wow.
For like a week, but I couldn't go. 2 days before I was to leave to ride with them on their plane, I got bookings. I got show gigs with Blackfoot. And to tell you how close fate is, or destiny, we were pulling into Columbia, South Carolina to play as Skynyrd was leaving Greenville, South Carolina. Pretty close. And I found out it happened that night while I was playing on stage. I was told about the crash after our gig. And I was hoping and praying that it wasn't, you know, just that people had survived it, that all of them had, you know. But I got back to the hotel and I called my parents, and my dad, it didn't even ring one time. My dad picked it up. And I said, Pop, tell me it ain't so. He goes, no, it's true. He goes, we're watching the news right now. They're doing a big report on it. And he goes, and they just announced Ronnie was one of the casualties. And I just was like, just, you know, I couldn't believe it. And so later, you know, later in years when I rejoined Skynyrd, this is so cool. When I rejoined Skynyrd in 96, we go to Europe to play our first tour together in 96. Oh. And we get over to Europe, and our last date is around, is on the anniversary of the disaster in October. October 96. And I get up on the bus at the hotel in London, and Gary's sitting next to me here with his wife, Dale. And I get up on the bus, and the next thing I know, I feel a slap on my arm. And I look over, and Gary said, "Well, where were you?" He goes, "Where were you?" I went, "Well, I was in the hotel." He goes, "No, no, no, not talking about that. You know what I'm talking about. Where were you?" I said, "Gary, we were pulling into Columbia, South Carolina, as you guys were leaving Greenville." And I said, "You know what, Gary, it's always gotten to me that I always thought maybe if I had been there, I might have been able to say something, do something to maybe change the course of what happened." And he looked me dead in the face. He goes, "You know what, Ricky? It wasn't meant for you to be there then. It's meant for you to be here now." And I promised Gary, I said, "Gary, I'll be with you from now till the last note in Freebird is played." And here I am, you know. I wish he was here. I still wish so hard that he was here still to play that last note with me at some point. But the powers that be saw different. And I still tell him every night on stage when I'm up there playing, "Gary, I'm still going to play that last note in Freebird."
Right. Awesome. That's good. Well, tell me this now. Lynyrd Skynyrd been around for so many years, you know, and there's a lot of bands that are retiring. Has anybody said, you know, maybe we need to pack it in? Is that something? Are you one of those guys that says, I'm going to always play, you know, you got to play guitar or something, right?
I, to be honest with you, everybody asked me, you know, "Man, when are you going to hang these guitars up and just, you know, sit back, relax, enjoy what you've got, what you've done, what you've made?" But you know what? I got into this because I love playing music. And I saw a great interview with Merle Haggard. And the girl was interviewing him. She said, she goes, "Mr. Haggard, I know we all know that you don't need this. You don't need to be doing this. You've got you've got your place, and you've got probably all that you'll ever need, so forth. But why are you doing this?" He goes, "Honey, I do this because this is what I do." "Well, I do this is because this is what Ricky does. I've got a side band, and, you know, when Skynyrd's off the road, I'm going to play. That's what I do. And that's what I enjoy, and that's what fulfills my life. You know, I've got a beautiful mate. I've got a beautiful woman in my life. She's been with me now 16 years, you know. I've got a beautiful daughter who's got her own life now. She's 32, and she's doing well. And you know what? Hey, you know, I to be honest with you, I never thought I'd be sitting here today, because you got to understand something. When I was about nine and a half years old, they went in surgically and cut out a whole section of my lung. Over here on the left side. And the doctors at that time told my parents, he won't live to see 14 years old. He won't live to see 14 years of age. Well, huh? That's been what, 60 years ago? And here, here I am. Years.
I think you proved him wrong. Oh, wow. Yeah. Hey, tell me, now I know a lot of people, especially these days, you know, I know you're talking about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is a farce because they're letting people in that's not even rock and roll. You can, you know, you could be a polka player, I guess, and get in.
Yeah. So it
probably
yeah.
takes the sting out a little bit. You know what I'm saying? But a lot of people are talking about these bands. You talk about the original members. Now, you are an original member, you know, according to what you know what you said, and that's the fact, right? So why do people say, I hear people say something about Lynyrd Skynyrd being like a cover band. Do you ever hear somebody say that? No, they said it with Foreigner. Do they say that? And you look at them like, shut up.
Well, they, you know, you know? We hear a lot of, you know, we hear a lot of, oh, it's nothing but a tribute band. Well, they even said that when Gary was still alive. But here's the way I look at it, okay? You know, you've got the original singer's youngest brother that has been in there almost 37 years. You've got me. That's my second go-round with the band. And I was in the original group, the formidable group, okay? And you had Gary, original founding member. Well, to us, us three guys standing up front, we were like, no. A tribute band is a band of all strangers that love to play cover songs and decide one day they're going to be a Lynyrd Skynyrd tribute band. There's a ton of them on YouTube.
Right.
You know? When you come to see right. Lynyrd Skynyrd, when you come to see us, it's full on tilt, original sounding, as close as you could ever possibly get. Okay? So the people sitting there behind their little computer keyboards and talking shit, they can talk that shit all they want to. All right? My word is, if you can do better than me, step up. You know what I mean? Come on. Come on with it.
Right.
Because that's Johnny good. And I, that's Johnny good. And I right now promised Gary. Gary made us promise that we would never, ever let the integrity of the band and the music history of the band and never let it be forgotten. Just all of a sudden, he's gone, the band's gone. And you might hear it on radio every once in a while, or people get together for a barbecue and they play the music or whatever, right? We got so much corresponding comments, letters, notes, email, text messages. And the one deciding factor was, please don't let this be the end of it. Well, okay. So if you really stop to think about this, all right, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards is the only original members in the Rolling Stones. I mean, Ron Wood's been there a long time, but
right.
Mick Jagger and Keith Richards right. is the original guys standing there. Okay. And they got all different musicians playing with them now. So, look, it's what we do. We play music. This is what we do. And you know what? Nothing is better than standing on that stage looking at that audience and looking at their faces. They're happy. They have forgotten their troubles, their blues. They've forgotten about world crisis. They've forgotten, you know, they're in the moment and they're loving it. And that's worth everything to us, you know? It really is. And it's all about the music. That music is so iconic, and it'll be here a lot longer right. than after you and I are gone, you know?
Sure, sure. Yeah, Sweet Home Alabama is my, it's where I live. So that's my theme song, man. So that music, though, it is forever. I mean, how do you stop that? I mean, but is that something you think that will happen? I mean, will the band continue for a while? Will there be different versions of the band? Will there be like some kind of, you know, in future years, what would be the future? Can you
Well,
even think about that?
Johnny and I made the agreement that whenever the time comes, we're going to know when to call it a day. And when Johnny and I decide to call it a day, that's going to be it. You know what I mean? You won't get me in a band to play Lynyrd Skynyrd music without Johnny being there. I think he thinks the same thing. So if anybody else wants to get in a band, they want to do that, go for it. You know what I mean? Go back to the clubs, go to playing the cover tunes, go to doing whatever. But we're the real deal. We are the real deal, you know? And I'm very, right. man, I'm a proud guy of being in the elite class of guys that made rock history and Blackfoot and Lynyrd Skynyrd, you know, the whole bit. I mean, I won't forget Jackson Spires, the drummer of Blackfoot. He and I wrote a lot of great songs together. Bass player Greg Walker, guitar player Charlie Hargrave. Here you go again. I was very honored and I felt very, gifted to be able to stand on the stage with, you know, three of the most incredible musicians I ever played with. So, you know, I just really consider myself very blessed and fortunate of being here today and you know, talking to you and explaining to you and talking to you about history and, you know, of what I'm doing and what I hope to accomplish and what the future looks like. You know, that's it.
Awesome. Well, not too many people can say that they were a drummer in one of the like biggest bands ever, left, had another band that was successful, came back to that other band and played guitar. I don't know too many people that. How many people have done that?
You know, my daddy used to call me. My daddy used to call me a chief cook and bottle washer. You know, he said, "My God, you do it all." You know, well, I tried to do it all because I tried to emulate him. And he sat me down one day and he said, "Hey, look, don't try to do what I do. Don't." You don't want to try to do what I do. You do what you do. He said, stick to one or two instruments and excel on that, and that'll take you further. You'll be all right. Well,
right.
I stuck to playing guitar, singing, and I played drums. There was my two instruments, you know? Although I did learn how to play. Pardon me. I did learn how to play mandolin. And dobro, slide guitar. You know, I learned how to play those, and I've used them in my career. But the guitar, there's something about when I'm, you know, I recently told my manager. One day, I mean, I called him up out of nowhere, and I said, you know, hey, bro, you know when I'm the happiest? And he goes, no, what, when? I said, when I have my old Explorer, my Firebird around my neck, and I'm standing up there in front of all those people watching how much fun they're having and how happy they are, I get lost. I said, I go into another world. And at the end of Freebird, everybody has noticed this about me. I just shake my head and open my eyes, and I come out of this, wherever I'm at, and back into this existence. And sometimes I think I leave my body and go somewhere else. And I give it my all. I give every ounce of energy that I can possibly muster to make it happen. And people often wonder, you know, if you got this thing going on, you know, how do you navigate? Well, I'll tell you how I navigate. I got an incredible medical, an incredible medical staff, an incredible doctor with his team of people. And they're the ones that got me from my 50s into my 60s and from my 60s into my 70s. And my doctor says, Ricky, we're going to get you into your 80s. Well, my significant goes, holy mackerel, if he's like this in his 80s, he's going to drive me nuts, you know?
And then go to 90s, and then, you know, hey, wouldn't you say, though, that music and guitar is just the best medicine for you and for everybody listening? That's probably why we're all still here, is that music really fills them up and keeps them going. I mean, I think music is like gas for everybody. You know, it makes those fans happy. It makes you happy.
Right.
It keeps you going, you know, right?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
And so to me, that's what it's all about. And it's for somebody like you to still do it after all these years. You love it. The fans love it. I mean, that's just incredible, all your accomplishments and everything. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, though, sucks. but, you know, I'm just saying.
Maybe one day they'll see the errors of their ways. I don't know. You know what I mean? But think about it in these terms. You know, Cher goes there and makes and causes a big squabble about it and raises hell and pitches a fit and everything like that, and they put her in. You know, maybe I need to go there and pitch a fit and raise a squabble and start a fight or whatever, you know? But I'll tell you what, man, if they don't see it necessary, then I don't know what they're thinking. I don't get it. And I know that I really feel in my heart, there's a biasness going on here. I mean, if you think about it, think about this one. I know he's controversial, and I know that a lot of people disagree with him, and I know that he's, hardline in his beliefs and so forth and so on. They've turned Ted Nugent down time after time after time. Now, here's a guy.
Yeah.
60, 70 million records sold, played stadiums, celebrated as one of the greatest guitar players ever. They won't even touch him. You know?
Right. That's
so that's what I get. That's what I say about being biased, you know?
Right.
I hope it's not because I'm Indian. Look.
That would be another thing that would be something else. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons they could throw at you, but they would never admit it, I don't think. They probably would never admit that. Which is sad.
No.
I don't know. Ted Nugent, though, one of the greats. Yeah, you're right. That's a topic everybody loves to talk about for the wrong reasons, you know. All the political whatever. It's got nothing to do. Nothing to do with his playing, but you know, whatever. It's stupid. And I hope that they'll reconsider. Maybe they'll watch this and go, this guy here, we need to reconsider this guy. I thank you though for talking with me today. I won't keep you any longer, but I just want to say that I've been a fan of yours for many years, and you're one of the greats. And let me say this too. You have a purpose. If you go through all that you've been through with your lung, you leave a band, you miss a plane crash, then you come back and you play and you're surviving and you're inspiring people. Your purpose is being served, and it's good to be an inspiration to people that maybe are going through some kind of illness, and they look at you and go, this guy's been playing with one lung for 60 years. You know what I'm saying? It's just crazy.
It's interesting because I'm getting ready to do, Mark and I are getting ready to put out another song. And I think the next charity, other than the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center, I think I'm going to do one of the great and donate to one of the real reputable, lung societies, respiratory societies. I really feel that's important, you know? Yeah. I'll donate to another animal charity. I love that, you know. My spouse and I, we love animals. That's one big thing that brought us together too, among other things. She's really special in her own way. Her name is Stacy Michelle. She spent 16 years as being one of the singers with Kid Rock. She spent 4 tours with Joe Walsh on his solo stuff, going out as the James Gang. We've been together 16 years and I still don't know everybody that she's been with and sang with. And now we get to travel together. She's in Lynyrd Skynyrd. She's one of the backing vocalists for us.
So cool.
Yeah. So, awesome. You know, I hope that no matter what, I can get to some good, reputable, respiratory foundation to donate to and to help others. What I'd really like to do is that, you know, I would like to visit children that are struggling and that are, you know, that are having problems, in hospitals, and be able to sit and talk to the little ones, you know, and listen to what they're saying, you know. Maybe they could draw enough strength for me to just really get over and to get through what they're going through. You know what I mean?
Right.
I know what it feels like. I've been there and done that, you know, and don't want to go back again. So, bless them, man. God bless those children that are struggling right now with that kind of stuff. It's tough. It's very, very tough. And, one of my best friends ever that lives out in Las Vegas, his daughter has just chronic cystic fibrosis. Mm. And she just struggles every day. And it's sad. It really is. You know? Anyway.
Yeah.
Everything's going to be good, my friend. Just making more music and playing more shows.
That's right. We'll keep going. Keep going. And hopefully I'll see you out there somewhere. I, like I said, big fan. Always appreciate your music. And train, man. I'm going to go play that right now.
All righty. Hey, if you ever if you see us coming around someplace, let Jody know. And
I will.
We'll take care of it.
All right, Ricky. I thank you so much.
Take good care, my friend.
Take care now. Yes, sir. We'll see you later.
Bye-bye.
And there he is, Ricky Medlock. What a guy. Very talented. A great conversation today. And I'm looking forward to talking to him again. And if you'd like to see him in concert, see his website for more information. Also, Lynyrd Skynyrd. See where they're playing near you. And until next time, everybody, always remember this. Keep the music real.